corporation is not a person. It doesn't think. People in it think. And for them, it is legitimate to create Terminator technology so that farmers are not able to save their seeds. Seeds that will destroy themselves through a suicide gene. Seeds that are designed to only produce crop in one season. You really need to have a brutal mind. It's a war against evolution to even think in those terms.
So, we're on PRSC Radio now. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers again. This week, Putin, a big speech about World War II, which was delayed since the 1st of May, which goes into some fascinating reasons that the Russians think were the real causes of the Second World War. It was them, of course, ultimately, that really won that war in Europe. And the president of Burundi dropped dead after expelling the World Health Organization from his country. Hong Kong also has banned satire, so you're not allowed to take the mickey out of the rich and powerful, particularly if they're in the Chinese Communist Party there anymore. And three Americans throwing light on the troubles of our day. First, Catherine Austin Fitz, who says the pandemic's being used to push a cashless society and digital currency agenda, which the elite wanted anyway. And she challenges the myth of Bill Gates' Microsoft self-made man. She runs something called the Solari Project. And then former US Army officer Mike Sparks from Alabama, I think we should call it. He looks at the pulling down of Confederate Albert Pike's statue in Washington, D.C. last weekend. Who was this Army commander who also commanded the Scottish Rite of U.S. Freemasonry? He was their Grand Master. And what about his 1871 letter predicting three world wars, two of which have already taken place just as he predicted? So what does the letter say exactly? And who is this guy, Nostradamus? That letter must be a forgery, surely. And then, did Churchill cut deals at the end of the war for the Nazi gold? Well, we think he does almost every week on here, as evidence comes to light, and much of it new evidence. The setting up of Hitler's treasurer, Martin Bormann, who escaped the Nuremberg gallows of one of the world's most powerful investment bankers in South America. Hey, what a better bankster, that one. We hear a sobering interview with the son of World War II journalist Paul Manning from CBS, who pursued the Nazi finances to the bitter end up until the 1980s. Just after his book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, was published in 1981, his publisher, Lyle Stewart, had both his legs broken, and Paul's brother, Jerry, was shot dead in cold blood in the streets of New York. The Fourth Reich really didn't want that book published. That's how important this story is. So we have a chat to Paul Manning, the son, Peter Manning, the son of Paul Manning, the author of that book, in the second hour after 6 o'clock. So joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, straight away, I think we really ought to look at the sacking of Rebecca Long Bailey, because it brings out so many of the problems that we've been looking at over the last 3 or 4 years to do with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, doesn't it?
Well, it's a bit of a shock in some respects, but on the other hand, it's almost predictable. And of course, the actual issue of whether the Israeli security forces train police officers in the US, well, I don't think there's any dispute about that. They do. So the idea that this
I'm afraid there is, because this is an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, Martin.
Well, what's happened here is that Rebecca Long Bailey retweeted an article by Maxine Peake, the actress, and in that article she said, and apropos of Black Lives Matter, that the techniques that are used by the police in the US, she said in the article, came from the Israeli Secret Service. Now, that's not quite accurate, although Shin Bet, and who are the Israeli Secret Service, have been involved in such training. But, of course, the military and the police in Israel routinely train US security forces. And of course, they're just about to annex on the July the 1st. They're about to annex the West Bank. And of course, what should be we should be talking about is boycott, disinvestment and sanctions on Israel for defying international law. And of course, this means that we're not going to talk about that at all because we're talking about this. And of course, there may be another strand to this, which is that Rebecca Long Bailey supported the teaching unions in taking a kind of safety first approach to reopening schools, whereas Starmer was inclined to go with Boris and just take a risk. And of course, that's what Starmer has basically agreed with Boris's political decision to end the lockdown.
You know, I would suggest to you it's much more likely that she was, Rebecca was a very strong contender for the leadership, that actually this is a way of simply Starmer knocking out his nearest rival from the cabinet.
She was included in the cabinet on the understanding that we were going to have a united party with all strands of opinion represented. Now she's been removed. That means that that strand of opinion has been completely removed from the shadow cabinet. Now, that's all very well. I was a voter for Starmer and she only got 28% of the vote. But loads of people who did vote for him, like me, did not vote for him to do this. And it's going to cause all kinds of problems going forward. But we've got 4 years before, in theory, we have another election in this country. And by that time, there could have been an intifada in Palestine, a war in Lebanon, and we will really see what side Keir Starmer is on. Because the pressure for boycott, disinvestment and sanctions is going to be overwhelming. And if people say that we're not going to talk about that, we'd rather talk about coronavirus, child poverty or whatever, I say to the pro-Israeli faction in the Labour Party is we are going to talk Israel, 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 day and night, day and night, day and night, until you confront the problems that this represents.
So you're insisting Martin, on Labour being an anti-Semitic party there, aren't you?
No, I'm not. No, we don't accept anti-Semitism is an absolutely terrible prejudice. And we're totally opposed to it. And of course, it's really offensive to be accused of anti-Semitism. Especially when it's not even true. And of course, the Black Lives Matter movement have already many times made it absolutely clear that they are in favour of boycott, disinvestment and sanctions on Israel, and that they don't a Palestinian boy, just like George Floyd, was killed, an autistic boy was killed by gunfire by the Israeli security forces just last week. And of course, that should be in Keir Starmer's mind. Now, I know he's married to a Jewish woman, and I know that he doesn't support boycott, disinvestment and sanctions. But I'm afraid as we go to war over what Israel is doing in Syria and Lebanon, he is going to be put on the spot. And he's got to have a think to himself, where did Tony Blair lead us during that period?
Well, I mean, he's already had a think for himself, hasn't he? And he's decided he's going to clean up the Labour Party
What we could see is a split in the Labour Party. The campaign group of socialist have already said that they're not happy with this. Now, that means there's a substantial chunk of the Labour Party which are withdrawing their support from Starmer. He's alienated them. Now, he may think he can get away with that and that the Daily Mail will like it, but I think he's going to find going forward that he's made life more difficult for himself, not easier. And we are going to hold his feet to the fire on boycott, disinvestment and sanctions. He's going to come out very strongly next week and condemn the annexation of the West Bank, which is an absolutely warlike policy. And if he doesn't do it, for example, the thousands of young people that were protesting about Black Lives Matter in this city last week and when the statue was toppled, those people are all absolutely behind the idea that the Israeli state needs to be isolated. And if he wants their support, he's going to have to start talking like that.
Well, he doesn't really need it, does he? He's already the leader and he's in charge for another 5 years. One of the things that Amnesty have been saying recently, though, and I was surprised that Keir Starmer hadn't necessarily read this one, it's from Amnesty USA saying, with whom are many US police departments training? With a chronic human rights violator, Israel, say Amnesty.
That's Amnesty International.
Amnesty
International anti-Semites as well, I suppose they are, according to Starmer. But it's what's really going on is the book. It was the Jewish, the pro-Israel lobby who immediately demanded that he do something about this, and he's just thrown them some red meat. But those people aren't Labour supporters. They support Netanyahu. They are right wingers. They are basically racists because they're not prepared to accept Palestinian rights. Now, if this row is not going to go away, if Keir Starmer thinks that by sacking Rebecca Long Bailey, he's killed off this whole argument about what Labour policy should be on Israel, he's wrong, because this is going to come back and back and back again until he confronts what he needs to confront, which is the Israeli government, not the left wing of his own party.
Let's get very specific to the George Floyd case here. Steve Sweeney, 1st of June this year in the Morning Star, Minnesota cops were trained by Israeli forces in restraint techniques. Now, officers from the U.S. police force...
Including that kneeling technique.
Officers from the U.S. police force responsible for the killing of George Floyd received training in restraint techniques and anti-terror tactics from the Israeli law enforcement officers. Mr. Floyd's death in custody last Monday, this was beginning of June, this article, the latest in a succession of police killings of African Americans has sparked continuing protests and rioting in U.S. cities. At least 100 Minnesota police officers attended a conference hosted by the Israeli consulate in Chicago, the second time such an event had been held. Here they learnt the violent techniques used by Israeli forces as they terrorize occupied Palestinian territories under the guise of so-called security operations. The so-called counterterrorism training conference in Minneapolis was jointly hosted by the FBI. Now, this is all very, very close to home for that killing of George Floyd. It would be very interesting to know if those specific officers who killed George Floyd had actually attended that specific conference, Martin.
Well, in what way was Maxine Peake wrong or anti-Semitic to point out these intimate links between U.S. police departments and the militarized?
Well, no, she wasn't. And what's the point then in Keir Starmer sacking Rebecca Long Bailey in the long term? Who is he? Whose interests is he working in?
Well, we all know that he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, so he's basically an establishment insider. And of course,
but he's also part of the Trilateral Commission, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the point is that he's just looking at the sort of, you know, workaday politics of this. He's basically saying, and of course he's getting loads of claps and cheers from the usual idiots in The Guardian and so on, because he's now basically pushed the left of the party out of the shadow cabinet. Now, he can do that and we can't stop him. But on the other hand, it's storing up trouble for the future.
At some point, he's going to
need support from that quarter, and he ain't going to get it.
What about this whole idea of saying that criticism of the Israeli state, which this is anti-Semitic? Isn't that a little bit like saying the criticism of an Italian restaurant is anti-Catholic?
Well, the point about this, that the nub of this matter really is the annexation of the West Bank next week. Now, what may happen is you could have a Palestinian intifada. They may go out to the streets and start fighting with the Israelis, in which case lots of people are going to be killed. And he's got to make his mind up which side he's on.
So what you seem to be saying here is that this may be a preemptive strike, knowing that there's going to be a lot of tension between Israel and Palestine. The idea is that anybody that might have a high profile, say, for example, being in the shadow cabinet that would speak out in defense of Palestinians, is being knocked down before they have a chance to say anything.
Well, we shall see, won't we? We will see whether that's the case. But I think if he thinks that the Middle East is just going to be a non-issue and he's settled all this now, he hasn't. The right-wing Jewish lobby in this country, pro-Israel lobby, they are crowing. But there's no reason for them to crow, because in actual fact, we're going to make this a major issue at the next election.
I noticed just over the last couple of weeks that Zionists with the Israeli flag have appeared at far-right rallies, the anti-Black Lives Matter rallies, which is quite interesting to see.
That's right.
But what about this international Holocaust denial guidance that's been adopted by all of the Labour leaders obviously including Rebecca Long Bailey and Keir Starmer in the leadership contest?
It's not Holocaust denial. It's supposedly what defines anti-Semitism, but it's not internationally accepted. I mean, basically, the nub of the matter is that questioning the existence of the state of Israel is anti-Semitic. But I'm afraid it isn't. It's just politics. Kosovo is recognised by many countries, but it's not recognised by Spain.
Okay, what about comparing the Israeli state to the Nazis, Martin? What about comparing, say, for example, Netanyahu to Hitler or the Israeli state to the Nazis?
Well, if you look at the press in Israel, you will find that that's a very normal term of political abuse that people use. They use it all the time. And I suppose because they're all Jewish, they're allowed to say so. But if they're allowed to say so, why isn't everybody else? The Israeli right wing was modelled on Mussolini's black shirts. It was. And they can't deny it. They were. And they've got a right wing ideology. That's what Einstein said about them when he wrote a letter to the 40s. He said they've got the same ideology as the Nazis. That's what Einstein said.
What about bringing this all up a bit more up to date, how US-funded fascists in Ukraine mentor US white supremacists? And not only are the white supremacists from across the West flocking to Ukraine to learn from the combat experience of their fascist brothers-in-arms in Ukraine, they're doing so openly under the nose of a shrugging law enforcement, chronicling their experience on social media before they bring their lessons back home. But Martin, one of the shocking things there is they're being supplied with Israeli weapons.
That's right. Colin Moisky, who's the eminence grise behind Zelensky, he is a Jewish oligarch from Ukraine, and they are aligned with the Azov battalion, who are openly anti-Semitic racists. And it's
well, they're Nazis, bizarre. Martin. They have Nazi symbols and this sort of thing.
I know. And the Israeli state is in line with anti-Semitic racists. Those are their allies. That's how bad it is.
Why do people point at Ukraine, though? Why is it that there's so many of these Nazis, modern day? I mean, you know, one can use the word neo-Nazi to describe all these groups, but actually some of them are openly pro-Nazi.
Yes. Well, I mean, the situation, as you know, I mean, the Ukraine had a terrible experience in World War II, and the Jewish community, the Baba Yar massacre outside Kiev, which led to Shostakovich's famous symphony. There is a history of this kind of poisonous racism in that part of the world, and of course the misunderstanding of what happened in Ukraine is massive in the West. People just don't understand it. The shootings at the Maidan Square, which precipitated the coup. We've had a court case in Kiev now where the Burkut riot police were vindicated because snipers testified from Georgia on Skype that they were the ones who carried it out. And they'd done it in alliance with the current government in Ukraine and the Western intelligence services, including MI6 and Mossad. And they killed those pro-European demonstrators, not the Russians.
They have something called the Rise Above movement. They have the Azov, openly Nazi Azov battalion. Yeah. They have C-14 Ukraine, Semnaya, Nazi Ukraine. There seems to be an amazing different number of these. Oh, I'll put a link up on our show page to this, including a political party, the Svoboda Party, which is also openly pro-Nazi in Ukraine. Yes. And yet these people are being armed by the Israelis?
Yes, they are. And it's all part of a general strategy.
And so, of course, you know, someone must maybe make the comparison between the Nazis and the Israelis on that occasion. But that apparently is anti-Semitic.
Well, I mean, the problem is that if you talk about anything serious to do with what's going on in the world in relation to the Middle East or in relation to Eastern Europe, then you're going to be talking conspiracy, because it is a conspiracy. Those demonstrators in the Maidan Square were all shot with the same rifles in the head. 80 plus of them. And the people who shot them were not the Russians. It was our own secret services working with Mossad.
Okay, so what's your prediction for the annexation of the West Bank then? What's going to happen there, or Gaza? What's happening?
Well, what may happen, and I'm not saying it will happen, because the people in Palestine are under very heavy manners, is that they may just go into the streets and say, well, there's nothing to lose now. We might as well try and fight back. And, of course, the Israelis will then... If there's a major, what the Israelis may do is attack Lebanon. The Hezbollah and everything are getting ready to fight in Lebanon. And, of course, you know, Trump may just decide that he's going to... I mean, apparently, according to John Bolton, Trump gave the OK for the Israelis to carry out airstrikes on Iran. And that could happen. And then we'll see where Keir Starmer stands, eh?
Yes, we will. And we'll talk a bit more about international issues in part two. But, Martin, I thought we'd come back a bit closer to Earth now and have a look at some of the stuff going on here in Bristol. Not statues this time, but it is 30 or so people living in caravans. There was an attempt to evict them last week. So let's have a listen now to Bristol Housing Action talking about the Glenfroom Road eviction last weekend, and we speak now to Ben Ritchie.
My name's Ben Ritchie. I'm a member of Bristol Housing Action Movement, which is a campaigning group for squatters, travellers and homeless people.
Saturday there was a big eviction attempt at Glenfroom Road, the old gasworks that some people will know on the edge of St Werburgh's. Can you just tell us how many people were there and what was the site like that people were living on?
It's a very big site, surrounded by a high wall with one gate. It's an old gasworks site. The eventual number of people was about 100 people turned up. There are about 30 travellers there, and the rest were supporters who turned up for the eviction.
Now, I understand it was a common law eviction, where this is the idea that you don't have to go through a court, but you can be evicted anyway. What I thought was that that can be done for open land, but you can't do it if there's a building on the site, and there was a building on the site. So can you just give us an idea, because there are different sorts of evictions, aren't there?
Yes, it was a building on site. It was a brick building with a steel door with a legal warning on it. So it was quite clearly an occupied building. The whole site is much bigger than the building, but I don't think that's the point in law. So therefore, the idea of a common law eviction wouldn't apply.
Okay, so roughly how many people living on site?
At least 30 people were there.
Okay, and they're not actually in anybody's way. These bailiffs aren't necessarily registered. They're not part of the bailiffs association. So how is it possible to get an eviction order without going to court? Most people would think you've got to go to court if you want to evict somebody.
Well, this is where the common law eviction comes in. It is possible to use common law on open land. It's a bit of an anomaly, really, dating from the Middle Ages. Trial by combat, really. The thing is, most councils have been advised not to use it. Local government associations have been advised not to use it, obviously, because it's so tricky. And
well, we're also in the middle of a pandemic. There wasn't any social distancing or precautions taken. And then the other question, of course, is where are the people who were evicted supposed to go?
Well, yeah, clearly we understood there would be no evictions during the pandemic, but that's been totally ignored. There is no interest in where the people go. They would have just been towed onto the side of the road outside the site.
What about the failure? Because it was 18 hours from early in the morning until midnight on Saturday. That's a long time. How come, with all these bailiffs, that it wasn't possible to evict people?
Well, without giving anyway very many trade secrets, basically people climbed onto caravans and any vehicles that the bailiffs brought in, making it impossible for them to move. The police obviously attended very quickly, and any attempt to bring people down from height would have been opposed by the police. So,
well, in the bigger picture, there's lots and lots of travellers out there, people living in vehicles. Actually, some people say more nowadays because of the very high private renting sector. Difficult to find somewhere to live, and this is, for many people, it's the only way to live, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the only way. People have been pushed either into living in dangerous or unsanitary buildings or unsuitable buildings, or in vehicles, or simply tents and places out of the way.
Is squatting still legal? Because that's what they were doing.
Squatting is still legal in non-residential premises, which is a bit of an oddity. So places that are suitable to live in, you can't squat. Places that are more or less unsuitable, you can. So we're in a very odd situation in Britain.
So people need to know more about squatting. Where's the best good place to go?
The best place to come is the PRSC drop-in every Tuesday 2 to 4 p.m.
Also, that's just on Jamaica Street, isn't it, in Bristol?
Yeah. Also, they can phone our our number, which 07833 100 399, and find out more about squatting, or they can go on our website.
Now, nationally, there's something called ASS, Advisory Service for Squatters, so there is still squatting going on right across Britain.
Yes, it's mainly in the south of England, but there is squatting all over the country. Obviously, most people try and keep it under the hat, because even if you are in a legal situation, you're liable to get trouble. So,
well, it's nice to know that if you do need a bit of legal advice, that there are networks out there that will give you a hand.
That's right. ASS are the national network. They're very busy, but if you get in touch with them, they have excellent connections to solicitors and other forms of advice.
Okay, Ben Ritchie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Martin, this is a bizarre situation here. You know, first of all, we're supposed to be doing social distancing. Then you've got about 40 police and bailiffs all crowding together, right? Basically piling on top of each other in like a rugby scrum in order to try and get into a site to evict between 30 and 50 homeless people in caravans. It does seem as if there's one rule for some people and another rule for others. I mean, if those people were, so, for example, trying to have a street party down the road, even if there was social distancing going on, they wouldn't be allowed to do it. And yet the police are actually involved there in something where people... I mean, what do you make of this? There seems to be some social distancing seems to be being kind of cancelled in some circumstances and not in others. And when it comes to evicting poor people, that seems to be social distancing, it doesn't matter at all.
Well, I mean, it's reprehensible that the council should be, or whoever owns that land, is taking.
Well, it's
this
actually Wales and West Utilities. It's a privatised utility company.
Right. Well, I mean, we've got to have a sensible policy, because basically, for many people, it really is impossible to put a roof over your head. And lots of people who are working, for example, they can't afford rent. So that these people aren't people living on benefits. They're often working in the gig economy, and the only way to function in the gig economy is to try and get to a situation where you don't have to pay rent at all.
I mean, the other mystery about this particular eviction, particularly. I mean, evictions are, I think, you know, newsworthy and interesting in many cases, particularly when you've got scores of people being made homeless. And this complete disregarding of social distancing by the police in this occasion, it is that the bailiffs employed were a company called GRC, who do these common law evictions, which are really only supposed to be used on open land and traveller sites. And yet this site is not open land, it's walled in, and it's also got a building on it. And they are basically going round the law. The common law eviction means you don't have to go to court. You don't have to really give proper notice to do the eviction. And in fact, many of the bailiff firms in the city are very annoyed with the company Graham Rose Consultants, GRC, who are carrying out these evictions. I did an article about them a few years ago, which is the article's title is Bailiffs in Balaclavas, because they usually turn up wearing various clothes in order to disguise their identity. Anyway, so why would a very wealthy company like Wales and West Utilities use such what is effectively a kind of cowboy operation without going through the courts, a cheap way of evicting people?
Well, you better ask them that. I mean, they need to. I mean, if they are a utility company, they're supposed to have some social purpose, even if they're privatised. And in any case, they should follow the procedure rather than, as you say, use cowboy firms that are actually trying to run rings around the law.
Isn't there something sort of linking these two, the sort of, you know, anti-traveller, privatised utility? It's a bit of a right-wing agenda, possibly.
Well, it's everywhere you turn, where people find that they can't make any progress in life. Young people in this city are staring into a miserable future of low paid work, transient housing, and real problems of getting a roof over your head, and no end in sight. Because, of course, when the furlough schemes run out at the end of the summer, there's going to be a massive spike in unemployment.
OK, well, we've also had a big protest over the last couple of days on the council house. I think, is it called City Hall? These days by Extinction Rebellion, saying that we shouldn't be allowing any cars into the city, and various things, which you know, is not very popular generally. I mean actually the mayor is just pedestrianizing large parts of the city center, so just seems an inappropriate bit of protest time to be protesting when the mayor is actually doing this anyway. But I thought I'd focus on a much less well-reported protest this week, and that's about the installation of the 5G masts here in Bristol. And I spoke to Philippa Winkler, who's one of the local campaigners against 5G, earlier this week.
My name is Philippa Winkler, and I'm working with the Bristol Residents for Safe Technology. We've been working on alerting the public about the health dangers of radio frequency radiation in general. And now with the increased danger of 5G, we've been alerting the public. And we know that a lot of the public are already quite concerned.
The government has done its testing on this technology. Surely it's just a question of replacing the antenna or the mast or whatever and getting on with the job.
Well, the fact is that there's been no outcry for any faster Wi-Fi. Everyone's quite satisfied with what they have. This is an imposed need that we're told we need it. Actually, people aren't running out and buying 5G phones. The difference is maybe a question of a second or
Hang on, you just said Wi-Fi. So I'm talking about data, phone data. That's what I think of 3G, 4G, 5G. Is it somehow different, or what's the similarity and the difference between 5G and Wi-Fi?
Well, 5G is what's being emitted, that's going to be emitted on devices all around. That's going to affect everything, phones, Wi-Fi, everything. There's going to be 5G phones, there's going to be 5G devices. Anything that's Wi-Fi will be affected.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? It's also because most of the, I mean, basically Wi-Fi has just been Wi-Fi, you know, but what you're saying is with 5G, not only are you going to get faster speeds and a ramp up on your phone's data, but also when you're using Wi-Fi, it's a faster form of Wi-Fi.
If you look at all the promo, it sounds like it's going to be faster. Yeah, that's what they say. Yeah.
What about safety, though? Because surely the government and the EU have done tests on all this stuff.
Well, basically, they're not doing tests. What they're doing is relying on a very small group called the International Commission for Non-Ionizing Radiation for the Protection of. And this is a very small group that has got deep roots, deep links with the telecommunications industry. There was recently two European Union MEPs have come out with a report, that a 90-page report, to say how much this small group, it's called ICNIRP, ICNIRP, have deep links with the telecommunications industry. And this is what we're told is our ultimate authority. They, all of the PHE, the Public Health England, the government, the councils, they all refer to ICNIRP, which is a small 13-member group. I think they operate out of Germany. And they're putting out information that's essentially contrary to what many peer reviews, thousands of peer reviews studies say, which is that Wi-Fi and mobile phones are linked to cancers of the brain and also has very bad impacts on reproductive organs. And
okay, so ICNIRP, the coven or the cabal, if there are a lot of people there from the industry, obviously they're going to want to find that this is safe. They're not really going to have a great deal of interest in saying, oh gosh, this is unsafe, therefore killing off their industry. And I think probably useful to put a link up on our show page to this report by your two MEPs. Can you give us any more information about that to make it easier for people to find?
Stop5g.co.uk is going to have it up on their site.
Okay.
You can also go to Action Against 5G, which is the legal case that's going on. It's just come out, so...
Can you give us your assessment then as to what you think the health risks are? Since it seems quite obvious that there is a bias of the regulators towards the industry, what are people in Bristol, people like you, saying?
Look at the peer-reviewed evidence. I mean, we have to rely on the science. And as we've found out, you know, science is not an exact science. There are many multiple opposing viewpoints when it comes to deciding about biology. One of the main problems is it's the electrical engineering community have decided what the health standards are around Wi-Fi and RAF. And it's biologists and health practitioners, people like that, who should be deciding what the health impacts are.
I understand also that there's been quite a lot of campaigning within the 5G community against the coronavirus, people that think that there's some sort of link between the two. Are you one of those?
No, there hasn't been a lot of campaigning about it. In fact, if you look at any of the Facebook pages or anything that we have got going in Bristol, for Bristol for Safe Technology, there's maybe like one nutcase that will say that. But honestly, most of the campaigners I know, myself included, do not see evidence that there is a direct link between the CB19 and the 5G. For example, if you look at Iran, Iran had the high, one of the worst epidemics of the CV19, and it doesn't have 5G.
Okay. Well, look, another criticism that's been levelled at the 5G community is the destruction of 5G masks, people climbing up and basically taking those masks down, taking them out, maybe cutting wires. Has any of that happened in Bristol?
Well, first of all, where did it happen? Nothing happened like that in Bristol. But here's the thing. What's the evidence that it was linked to the 5G campaigners? Has there been any police investigation of these masks? And how many? And supposedly, MobileNet, which is a very small sort of PR company, they came out recently and said, oh, well, 77 of these masks were affected. But where's the evidence? We haven't seen any police investigations. We know there's that some of these masks are combustible anyway. That happened in New Zealand when one mask just combusted on its own, because this is electricity that we're dealing with and high-level electricity at that.
Well, I mean, and you see, I suppose they get hot too if they're being used.
Exactly.
Surely it's an obvious connection to make that if the masks have been destroyed, then it must be the campaigners like yourself doing it.
Well, again, we go to the evidence. We always go to the evidence, whether it's the link, the alleged link between CB and 19, whether it's the alleged actions of 5G campaigners. And we wonder, where is this really coming from? You know, why is there no evidence? Why are these allegations being made? It ends up by impugning our campaign, which is a very valid campaign, which is based on evidence. We do have a lot of evidence. We have 230 scientists who've signed a petition to stop 5G. We've got cities all around the world that have halted and banned rollout of 5G. I can quote some, like Brussels, Ireland, County Clare, Ireland, a lot in Ireland, Totnes. In the USA, there's been hundreds of cities that have halted 5G. And just yesterday, two French ministers of the government actually said we need to halt 5G. So this is what we're looking at. We're looking at the evidence, and these people who are officials, community organizers, and also, you know, people who are in charge of local government are looking at 5G very carefully and calling for a halt. And this is a global, worldwide movement.
Well, I'm interested in what's going on in Bristol particularly, and I noticed that Mayor Marvin Rees has been 100% behind this technology, which is surprising since, as you say, there's an enormous amount of influence of the industry on the regulation of 5G. And also, during the lockdown, there have been a whole load of planning applications that have magically somehow the council staff have appeared at their desks and processed these planning applications. Isn't that correct that we've had quite a lot of applications, and there's a lot of masks due to go up, which were applied for during the lockdown?
Yeah, that's right. We've had at least 13 or 14 applications that happened during lockdown, which means that it was impossible for people. They're supposed to put up notices in the streets to ask for comments about a planned mask. And of course, if you're under lockdown, you can't go out in the street and look at any notices. You can't even send your objection for one reason or another if you're shielding. So we were being very restricted. And that's when they brought in all these applications, because you only have 3 weeks to make an objection. But it's made it impossible to make objections when you're under lockdown, unless you had a computer. Not everybody has a computer. And not everybody saw the notices. So we found that by going around, for example, the Butler House residence, sheltered accommodation, that the elderly there had no clue what was going on until we alerted them. And also the school by Butler, this is St. George, the school of Summerhill Infant School, which is only going to be 200 metres away from the mast that's planned, had no idea. because the school was shut.
Well, just a minute, because whenever there's a planning application, the school would have been sent a letter by the city council saying there's a planning application. What, you know, would you like to comment?
Well, perhaps, but if the school was closed for 3 months, I don't know the exact details of what went on. All I can tell you is that the head teacher at Summerhill Infant School had no idea. And as soon as he found out, he lodged a very solid objection on the Bristol Community Planning website, basically saying that we as a school were deeply concerned about the effects on the health of our very...
Well, I mean, this is quite interesting, isn't it? Because it sounds to me as if the telecoms firms that are putting these up, plus the lobby that exists within Bristol City Council for all this, are trying to get these masks up through the back door and using the coronavirus as an excuse.
Well, I don't know what's going on in their head, but the fact is we do feel railroaded into the erection of these monocle masks and without due notice. So we have asked to have extension of decisions, and they're being pretty tough about it. But we still can get in our objections. Like today, for example, we can get into our objections to the 5G mast on Butler House. We're asking people to do that, to go to stop5g.org/Bristol.
I mean, I'm just amazed because the city council really should be doing this work. This is what we pay the council tax for. They should be alerting people when there's something potentially dangerous going up on the top of their house or next door or their kid's school. I mean, one of the things that does bother me, Philippa, is this lobby that exists within Bristol City Council for 5G. There's the main one is called Bristol Smart City. Now, Bristol Smart City exists to promote this technology. And I must say, every time I see the word smart this or smart that, whether it's a smart payment, a smart phone or whatever, I think actually it's a stupid thing because, you know, you have to use your phone on the internet and stuff because the BBC isn't telling you what you need to know. The smart technology is actually reversible. So what I'm trying to say, I suppose, is that if you have access to information, then people like GCHQ, the NSA, private interests also have access to all of your information on your phone. They also have access to your home through things like smart meters. And so smart actually in many ways means stupid. But Freya Lockwood, who works for Bristol Smart City, is a former employee of Kinetic Aerospace Engineering. Now, they're the privatised version of what used to be called DERA, the Defence Evaluation and Research Establishment, which does weapons for the military, high-tech electronic weapons. And so she has hopped straight out of that job at Kinetic, probably working, maybe working on Salisbury Plain or somewhere like that, and into this job in Bristol City Council. The other person who's been pushing this is from Bristol Is Open, which I understand the university have now pulled their funding from, but which is was set up by Bristol City Council, and that's Julie Snell. Julie, actually, she had an interior design job for a while, but her previous job was working for BT Networks on promoting them. So what we've seen in Bristol, actually working behind the scenes within the City Council, paid through council taxpayers' money, is somebody from the military electronic weapons research arm and somebody else from BT there to give, I suppose, what they would call impartial advice to planners and the city council on the rollout of 5G. So this is a quite a powerful lobby, Philippa, isn't it?
Oh, it's very powerful. You mentioned privacy and security concerns. Actually, this 5G is very porous, and that is a major concern. It's one of the reasons that even the military in the US is concerned about the use of 5G because of this. It's very easily hackable. And the other part of that is you mentioned the sort of collusion really between government and corporations. Well, that's very true. This is what's happening because of the funding. How much funding is coming from the government, the UK government, into corporations and small private and small projects like the smart cities, you know, various projects. BBC is getting some money from the 5G project funded by the government. You know, they're all getting their piece of gold. So there's a lot at stake here.
Okay, so you were down at the Summerhill School this week and at Butler House. What were people saying down there and what were you up to?
Well, we were passing out flyers and explaining how, you know, they could comment on the planning application, which is still up, and it's going to be finished today at 5 p.m. So we are asking people to keep commenting. We've got 100, as a result of everything, we've got a very good reception. The parents were very interested. They thanked us for coming over. They had no idea what was going on. And they've got, so far on this site with very little notice, there's been a 127 objections lodged, that were lodged on the planning site, for Butler House. Also just want to mention the Bedminster Mast that they want to put up, where there's a school near a school and a nursery, and, that local residents have got wind of that, and they've lodged 125 objections so far on that.
Now, one of the reasons I know that people are concerned about schools is because this electromagnetic radiation, the pulse radiation, which is actually effectively microwaves, damage children's cells more than they do adults. They tend to, don't they?
Right. Yeah, that's been the peer-reviewed studies that have said that, yeah.
Okay, so if people want to follow what you're up to and maybe give you a hand or even phone you up to ask you questions and contact you some other way, what's the best way to follow what Bristol Against 5G is up to?
Right, go to stop5g.co.uk.
Okay, Philippa Winkler, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome, thank you.
One of the most concerning things in all of that is this Freya Lockwood woman, who I've tried to contact many times, and she just simply doesn't return my calls in Bristol City Council. From Bristol Smart Cities, used to work at DERA, it's actually Kinetic, isn't it? But this is an equivalent of something in the US, which people may know called DARPA, which are developing weapons. I mean, why is somebody pushing this in the city who's a weapons developer?
Well, I mean, one answer to that is it's just transferable skills. But it's also the case that 5G is very important for military purposes, which is one of the reasons why they're pushing it, and why, of course, this whole rowing about whether Huawei should be allowed to participate in this country. Because, I mean, I think from the Chinese military point of view, they see 5G very much as them, you know, as part of their military strategy.
Now, we haven't done Prime Minister's questions. We should have been, really. Let's have a go let's look at Northern Ireland now. And there was a question came up, which I think you'll find interesting, Martin. It looks as if there is going to be some kind of border going up between Northern Ireland and Britain. Let's have a listen to Prime Minister's question on that now.
Governor Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister has stated that when we leave the EU at the end of this year, Northern Ireland will still remain a full part of the United Kingdom. Yet I have in my hand a letter received by the management of the Port of Larne only this week stating that they have to prepare to become a border control post, and 14 acres of land has been looked at for car parking or for lorry parking and for construction, and there's a sense of urgency since these proposals have to go to the EU by the end of the month. Can the Prime Minister explain how Northern Ireland can remain a full part of the United Kingdom if people coming from the rest of the UK into Northern Ireland have to pass through a border control post? And would he advise the management to tear this letter up as well?
Mr. Speaker, I haven't seen the letter he described, but I can tell him absolutely categorically that there will be no new customs infrastructure for the very simple reason that under the protocol it's absolutely clear in black and white that Northern Ireland is part of the customs territory of the whole of the United Kingdom and will be joining the whole of the United Kingdom in our new independent trade policy and doing free trade deals around the world.
So which planet are we on, Martin? Are we on the planet where there is a border and the letter, or there isn't? And Boris?
Well, when Boris agreed with the EU, the declaration, the EU agreed because it was all about basically nothing could be decided until they'd settled this Irish question. And there is clearly going to be an administrative border leaving and going into Northern Ireland. It's part of what's been agreed. And, of course, what could happen if we had a soft Brexit is that wouldn't mean very much, because basically the regulations are really the same on both sides of the border. But if you're going to go for a hard Brexit with trade deals with the rest of the world, then clearly Northern Ireland is going to remain in the single market, and there's going to have to be checks at that border and at Holyhead and at Larne. It's just inevitable. And of course, what Boris does, he just baldly states that it's not so, and it's not going to happen. But he's already agreed that it is going to happen. And it will happen, because the other alternative is to have a border on the island of Ireland. And the EU was saying, we're not having that. And the Irish government said, we're not having that. That won't happen.
It's always been a sort of sticking point, this, isn't it? Anyway, one of the things that I found quite interesting is that there is quite a big movement for the left-wing Brexit. It's obviously not being expressed through the Labour Party, which has been really campaigning either for another referendum or for Remain. But Martin, we're going to hear now from a guy called Paul Nags. He set up something called Labour Heartlands back in about 2 years ago, just after the time of the referendum, because he felt that much of the Labour opinion, particularly from the north of England, that really lost Jeremy Corbyn in the last election by voting Tory and voting, I suppose, on Brexit on that issue. Anyway, so let's have a listen now, because here he talks a lot about the new world of the Labour Party under Starmer, and also the campaign. He starts really off by talking about this enormous campaign inside the Labour Party that there was amongst staff to make sure that Jeremy Corbyn didn't succeed in the general election. So let's have a listen to, we have two, but this is the longer version, the longer interview with Paul Nags now.
This is not only sabotaging the Labour Party, this is absolutely appalling. This is sabotaging democracy itself. How can we have democracy if we don't have an opposition party that's trying to win? It becomes a one-state party, a one-state country. And we can't have that. That's not democracy in any way. And these people should be tried. You know, I mean, they are traitors to democracy. It's absolutely appalling.
Well, I mean, really, it's not a criminal offence. It's really just an offence of the people who are running the Labour Party, allowing people in who are there to undermine it.
Well, it's not a criminal offence. Or is it a criminal offence? I mean, if you're undermining democracy in a democratic country, are you a traitor to that country? And I know that sounds absolutely so harsh. However, if you don't have an opposition that's trying to win, you don't have an opposition. It becomes an illusion. And people deserve more than just an illusion of democracy.
You also mentioned Brexit there. What are the arguments for and against Brexit? And why did you feel that wasn't really being properly discussed within the media and within the other Labour Party forums?
Well, 2016, we witnessed both the Tory party and the Labour Party take a view of Remain. They both campaigned to Remain. Obviously, we know that joining the EU and the EEC were both Tory party propositions, and we joined under Ted Heath, and later we joined the EU under a Tory party as well, and socialists.
Well, yeah, under John Major, wasn't it?
That's
in fact,
right.
Margaret Thatcher was booted out in order to make way for Major joining the EU.
Well, 75, Margaret Thatcher campaigned for our joining the of the referendum, you know, to remain within the EEC, and to be quite honest, you know, she was a big pusher of the European project. It was only after her Bruges speech that she actually seemed to understand that Britain wouldn't benefit in the long term. We would lose our sovereignty and our democracy. And, you know, there's left and right wing reasons why we shouldn't be part of this EU organisation. After all, it is just a trade, economic trade organisation. That enhances globalisation, you know.
Why was it, do you think, that so many people, particularly in the north of England, the Labour Party, traditional Labour supporters, voted for Brexit, whilst the party was saying, hey, we're going to have another referendum?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll use that term, we're traditional Labour voters, and we grew up listening to people like Dennis Skinner and Tony Benn, and they were the tribunes of the people, and we listened to what they had to say, and we believed what they had to say is true and nothing's changed.
Can you tell us what it is about the EU that that these people and you feel isn't working then? Well, because, I mean, we're told that it's a great economic benefit, aren't we?
Well, we can take away the rules and articles that you know, seem to benefit some EU countries and not others. But the reality is it's about democracy. Yeah? When I vote for an MP, that MP represents me, my constituency, and the people within that constituency. They then reside in Westminster, and that is the art of our democracy. They understand the area and the people, and they're accountable to the area and people. They don't make laws en masse throughout Europe that has different meanings throughout Europe. They make laws for the people of that area and obviously for the UK because they understand the communities and the areas around. But basically, it's about democracy, where democracy resides. And democracy resides, and the accountability of democracy should be at Westminster, not some distant Brussels. I mean, there's lots of different reasons why you should, in my opinion, why we should have continued to just leave the EU and make a trade deal afterwards, and democracy being the front and foremost of it.
Okay, but I mean, a lot of the socialists, particularly, a lot of left-wing people are part of what they would call a socialist international. They want to see one great state to embrace socialism for everyone, and that they are looking at Brussels for that.
Well, I'm not sure if you could ever have international socialism within a construct which is a capitalist EU construct. Internationalism, to me, it has many different forms. For example, if we have a trade union within the UK that comes out in solidarity with a trade union, for example, the train strikes in France, if the RMT came out in solidarity with them in France, that would put pressure on the French government, because the British government would be putting pressure on them to say, get your strike sorted out. That's workers of the world uniting. That's real internationalism.
So that's Paul Nags there from Labour Heartlands. Martin, he makes some quite important points there. He's saying really effectively that the EU is a capitalist system. It's a capitalist club. Why would socialists want to join it?
Well, the point is that we were in it and we're leaving. So the idea of whether we're going to join or not is not really the issue, is it? I mean, that was the issue in the 1970s, but it's not the issue today. The issue is, are we going to be a part of the EU or not? And obviously, we're probably not. But then the question becomes, well, are we going to be part of the single market? And I think it's pretty clear that we're not. But I think all serious economic advice analysis that I've read, apart from Patrick Minford, who's an outlier, and even he admits that it's going to deindustrialise the country, is that a no-deal Brexit in December is going to crash the economy. I'm pretty confident that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, but I mean, you've been talking about why the economy is absolutely not going to survive anyway. You've been talking about that for the last 10 years.
What's going to happen is quite possibly there's going to be a global crash, in which case what happens in Britain will be covered up by this global crash that's happening anyway. And of course, being in or out of the EU won't protect you from a global crash. If Deutsche Bank collapses, Barclays Bank will collapse the same afternoon. That's what will happen, whether you're in the EU or out of the EU. And in fact, we've spent a lot of time arguing the toss about so-called democracy. We've never had any democracy in this country.
Do you want to just say something about the economic effect in a nutshell? We haven't got much time, but just in a nutshell, about the economic effect of this coronavirus, because that seems to me to be really not being talked about. There's two big questions which the mass media are not addressing. One is the enormous impact that this is having on an already teetering on the brink of the cliff economy, and the other is the whether or not it's a military thing. But anyway, what about the economic side of things?
Well, the financial system started imploding in September, and the Federal Reserve in the US, which has now become the Treasury, although it's been subcontracted to BlackRock.
Yeah, so amazing.
You couldn't make this up.
You couldn't.
They are basically and don't forget, we've got a Tory government that's going to renationalise the railways here. it's just amazing.
I mean, there
it?
Is one thing about this whole BlackRock business, and that is that aren't surely the companies like this are far more wealthy and powerful than governments anyway. So isn't it natural they should just take over from elected governments?
Well, that's exactly what's happening. And the COVID-19 shock was really basically, if it was deliberate, it's a mechanism by which the financial services sector was about to go down the drain again. And we could have decided, right, let's let them go. But we're not. And they've been shoveling money down their throats. The same thing's happening here. Richie Sunak, as I like to call him, Richie, because he's a multimillionaire hedge fund guy. They are shoveling money without oversight into various companies at every level.
You're only jealous, Martin, because you didn't make the career choice to be a hedge fund manager when you were at Oxford.
Well, indeed. I mean, I didn't go to Westminster School like he did, lots of other people.
Anyway, thanks to our guest, that's Martin Summers. We'll be back with Martin after some music to take our weekly look around the world. So that's the Moody Boys from 1990 with, guess what the title of that was? Anyway, welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Vladimir Putin, a big speech this week about World War II, which was delayed from the 1st of May due to the pandemic. And also the president of Burundi drops dead. Didn't hear about that one on the news after expelling the World Health Organization from his country. Also, Hong Kong banning satire. Actually, officially last weekend, no more satire and various jokes had to be taken off the air that were ready to go. Shows banned, sketches banned and all that sort of thing. Three Americans this week, though, throwing light onto the troubles of our day. First, Catherine Austin Fitz, who says the pandemic's being used to push a cashless society and a digital currency agenda, which is what the banksters want. Also challenging the myths, she's doing anyway, of Bill Gates is Microsoft's self-made man. She runs something called the Solari Project, which is advising investors as well as critiquing from a Christian point of view and a biblical point of view much of what's going on in the world today. Then former US Army officer Mike Sparks from Alabama. He looks at the pulling down of the Confederate Albert Pike's statue in Washington, D.C. last weekend, I suppose inspired by our very own glorious Colston puller downers, demonstrators. And what about his 1871, Pike that is, 1871 letter predicting three world wars? Supposed letter anyway, alleged letter, two of which have already taken place, just as Pike predicted. So what does the letter say exactly? And who is this guy, Nostradamus? That letter may be a forgery, like the Protocols of Zion, maybe. Then, did Churchill cut deals at the end of the war for the Nazi gold? The setting up of Hitler's treasurer, Martin Bormann, who escaped the Nuremberg gallows as one of the world's most powerful investment bankers. We hear from Peter Manning, the son of Paul Manning, author of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, one of the greatest US journalists of the Second World War, who was booted out of the profession, basically put out to grass because he was pursuing what we in the journalistic trade call, hey, this is the wrong story, pursuing a Nazi war criminal. And also Paul's brother, Jerry, just after the book was published, was shot dead in cold blood, as well as the publisher, Lyle Stewart, having both of his legs broken. The Fourth Reich really didn't want that book published. That's how important this story is. And what does it mean today? We finish with that one. But Martin, let's start with Putin, because it's been hardly reported at all, this speech by Putin. He really did a whole analysis of what went wrong with the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations, and he's saying, look, we've got to understand this if we want to prevent World War III.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you know, Putin is not given any sensible hearing in Western media. He's just regarded as a bogeyman. But the speech, I've seen extracts from it. It's basically giving the Russian version of World War II. And, of course, you know, plenty of people basically underestimate what they did, but they basically won the war in Europe single-handed. And it's quite possible, of course, that they were saying at the end of the war that they were going to invade, they invaded Manchuria and they were about to invade Japan. And, the all the fuss that was made about we had to drop the atomic bombs because there would have been a million casualties if the Americans and the British had tried to storm Japan. The Red Army was ready to storm Japan and they would have taken a million casualties. They'd already taken loads and loads and loads. Another million would just be another million. And they were ready to take Japan.
Yeah, given that that's why
they dropped bombs on them.
Given that the Russians lost about 20 times more soldiers dead and wounded in the Second World War than Britain and America combined, it's extraordinary,
and
isn't
civilians,
it?
Civilians, of course.
Well, yeah, as well. It's amazing, really, that they were fighting from 1941 right the way to the end. So that was really they were fighting for four times longer than we were.
Well, I mean, it's hard to quantify all of these things.
Well, the Russians would say that actually, in fact, I'm sure Stalin did say at the time when D-Day came, well, you left that a little bit late, didn't you?
Well, that's because if they didn't move at that stage, then the Soviet Union was going to take over the whole of Western Europe. And as you know, Tony, there's evidence to suggest that the Battle of Arnhem was fixed so that Bormann and others could escape. And, you know, the paranoia in Moscow that the West was intending to nuke them wasn't paranoia. Churchill said, "But let's Operation Unthinkable. Why don't we nuke them now before they get nuclear weapons?"
Well, I mean, back in a year after the Russians entered the war, well, after Operation Barbarossa, when the Nazis launched their attack on the Russians in 1941, a year later, Stalin had been banging his fist on the table saying, "Look, we're happy to fight this lot, but why don't you come over the channel and open a Western Front?" And they wouldn't, and they wouldn't. But on the 19th of August 1942, there was this raid on Dieppe. And actually, it was sabotaged by the British, as we now know, with John Ainsworth Davis going to Berlin as a double agent and telling the Nazis, well, in order to get into their confidence, this raid was coming. And so because the raid, which killed something like 3,000 Canadian soldiers, almost all Canadians died, the signal was sent to Stalin, well, we did try, but we didn't manage to do it. So that was quite a sneaky little maneuver, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And of course, if you read John Ainsworth Davis' book, he was actually on the cliffs as the Canadians were coming into Dieppe, and basically the Germans had said, if they don't come in where you say they're coming in, we're going to shoot you. But in fact, they came, and he said it was the most sickening thing in his career as a spy, because he knew that basically those soldiers were sacrificed so that he could become a trusted agent as far as the Germans were concerned. And that's the level of subterfuge that was going on.
Interesting that they chose Canadians to make that raid rather than British soldiers, isn't it?
Well, the Canadians were being pushed by their own people back home. Can you do, you know, they wanted to be seen to be doing something. But they were pretty cynically sacrificed, basically.
Anyway, so Putin is talking about Versailles as being really sowing the seeds for World War II, the treaty after World War I. Is that correct, do you think?
I think that's pretty much the way most historians look at it. It's quite obvious that the Treaty of Versailles was totally one-sided. The real problem was that the British were willing to forgive reparations to the German reparations, provided that the Americans forgave the British for the debts that they'd got into. But one top politician in the US said, well, they hired the money, didn't they? So basically, they took the view that they'd paid for the war, but they wanted the money back. And in fact, Britain only paid back in 2015 the money that we'd borrowed to fight World War II from the Americans. And that really caused all the problems. If everybody had taken a more realistic attitude, then World War II could have probably been prevented. And of course, Keynes famously wrote The Economic Consequences of the Peace, because he was one of the negotiators at Versailles, and he said, if you try and bankrupt the Germans, that's not going to do them any good. It's not going to do you any good. What's the point of bankrupting them?
One of the terms that Putin's using throughout this talk is something called the Munich Betrayal. Well, we don't get it called that over here, do we? It's called the Munich Agreement, and it's where Chamberlain came back from Munich from an agreement with Hitler saying, oh, it's okay, we're going to have peace in our time. You know, that's was the attitude in Britain. Why would Putin see it as a betrayal?
It was a crucial moment, because they were trying to build an alliance to stop Hitler. And both Poland and Britain agreed that Hitler could move into the Sudetenland. And at that point, the communists Stalin decided, that it made sense for him to do a deal with Hitler, because what was happening was that the Western powers were lining Hitler up to invade Russia. And so he thought he was going to be...
Well, no, Czechoslovakia, not Russia.
No. Ultimately Russia. Yeah, that's when the Stalin, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact happened after Munich, because before Munich there had been discussions. I mean, the Czechs were ready to fight, and the Red Army said, "Well, we'll come into Czechoslovakia and fight beside you." But the British decided to appease Hitler, and at that point Stalin switched sides. Foolishly, he was totally taken in by Hitler. He didn't believe when Barbarossa took place and the surprise attack on Russia, Stalin was stunned, because he didn't really think that he'd basically been completely fooled by Hitler. But you can see the justification in Russian eyes for that Molotov-Ribbentrop pact was that, we were ready to fight over Czechoslovakia and you decided to back down, so we're going to make our own arrangements with Hitler.
One of the Canadian academics has said that the Cold War started after 1917, or in other words, he was talking really about the Treaty of Versailles setting the scene for all of the things that happened right the way up to the Cold War.
Well, yeah, I mean, everything's connected to everything else in a long chain of events, isn't it? I mean, we're still living with the consequences of the First World War.
He also says that the Western elite actually rather liked Hitler. In fact, of course, as we know, even our own king was very pro-Nazi, Edward VIII, and maybe others who weren't prepared to say it openly. The Western elite saw Nazi Germany as a bulwark against the Soviet Union and Bolshevism.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what they were plotting to do was they were allowing Hitler to come to power with all sorts of help and support. Prescott Bush, for example, George W. Bush's grandfather, was very heavily involved in investing in German war industry. And the idea was that they would basically deal with the Soviet Union for them. But it didn't work out exactly as they planned.
So anyway, done a little bit there, I hope, to look at this fascinating bit of history, which has been covered, very, very much in Russia. A lot of Russians finding this interesting, having the history. And he's basically saying, I suppose the way to round off our discussion about Putin's speech this week, Martin, is he's saying that the Russians are a very stoic people and that they will perform very well if it's a crisis or a disaster. And he's really hinting that there may well be one coming down the road, either economic or war.
Well, the Russian general staff are preparing for war. There's no doubt about it. They've lost all delusions about the West. They realize it doesn't matter who wins the US presidential election. They're in for the long haul, but they're not reckless, and they don't want to fight, but they're definitely preparing to do so, as are the Chinese.
Okay, well, we haven't really talked much about the virus this week, but we'll be doing that in a minute by hearing the views of Catherine Austin Fitz on it. But Martin, we've seen this amazing amazing events this week with the death of this guy from Burundi, the president, just dropping dead after he expels the World Health Organization. There seems to be actually quite a lot of resistance within Africa to the programs of the World Health Organization, although they seem to be being generally embraced in Britain and America and the developed world. The African countries don't like it, it seems. In many cases, the resistance has come from there, as you pointed out a few weeks ago, with the bribe being paid, I think it was in Nigeria, wasn't it, in order to get a mandatory vaccination bill through.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't picked up on the fact that the president of Burundi had died or that he'd kicked the WHO out. But the WHO is an extremely flawed organisation, as we know. It ought to be a public sector body to coordinate world health, but it is, in fact, captured by the pharmaceutical companies and people like Bill Gates. I mean, why Bill Gates is the biggest contributor to it now that the US has withdrawn from it. And, of course, you know, something like the WHO probably has to exist. I was reading about what's going on in terms of building a vaccine, and the pharmaceutical companies are basically taking loads of lolly from the governments to develop vaccines, which they will then control the patents on. And that's the real issue. But these things shouldn't really be done in the private sector at all. Health issues are so important and so far reaching for the whole of humanity. I mean, if this pandemic or another pandemic comes out of the third world, it's going to kill everybody in the first world as well. There isn't the health is a holistic thing. You can't just have a, I mean, of course, and the whole model of healthcare in the US has been shown to be completely bust, where millions of people have no healthcare, even the richest, one of the richest countries in the world. And of course, things like a pandemic just expose the whole fallacy that you can somehow ensure private insurance can insure you against things like this. The answer is it can't anymore.
Now, I'm just looking at the fortruss.com. That's fort-russ.com's Africa section. I mean, none of this stuff is really being reported. I would have thought that almost every one of these stories would be a big deal for Black Lives Matter. Maybe they just haven't read this, but the World Bank apparently are using COVID-19 to further indebt the whole of Africa, pushing what they say, use the word debt slavery in Africa. It's what quite clear that Africa is plunging down into ever more debt and poverty over the last 2 or 3 months, the biggest increase in both that's ever been seen in Africa. And there are all sorts of, I mean, the main one really being the death of this Burundian president. I'll try and pronounce his name. Nkurunziza. Dying suddenly after expelling World Health Organization for what he calls a false pandemic. Now, the funny thing is here that our own National Health Service actually deregistered about a week or two after the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 to be a pandemic. Our own National Health Service actually degraded it down from being a pandemic very quickly. So in a way, they are doing it quietly, but he was doing it very vocally. The president of Burundi, Pierre Nkurunziza, 55, died following a heart attack. The sudden death comes as a surprise, as he'd been evaluated recently as being in overall very good health. But controversy has emerged in the African country as local pundits suggested his death was the consequence of poisoning. Less than a month ago, a Burundian government ordered the expulsion of all experts from the World Health Organization responsible for advising on the false pandemic, they call it, COVID-19. The president of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs declared the World Health Organization representatives were persona non grata on Burundian territory. For information to date, and despite its opposition to the World Health Organization, Burundi officially declared only one COVID death. Well, that's a little bit far-fetched, compared against 30,000 dead in France. So it seems that this guy was, to a certain extent, in denial about this virus, Martin, but very strange that he should just fall over dead, isn't it?
Well, it is, but you can't presume anything until you've investigated thoroughly. It reminds me a bit about Thabo Mbeki in South Africa, who claimed that HIV didn't cause AIDS. In defiance of scientific opinion, and in some countries they really don't want to think about COVID-19 because they haven't got any resources. Even if you knew that it's ripping through the population, what can you do? You haven't got the resources to deal with it.
I suppose you have to treat it as just a, say, some sort of ordinary like annual flu or something.
Well, I mean, the problem is in many parts of the world. I mean, Latin America is obviously in a very bad way, with Bolsonaro in Brazil basically in denial about the existence of the virus, even as they've got mass graves in Manaus in the Amazon.
Okay, let's just move over to look briefly at Hong Kong, because we were talking last week, weren't we, about Fawlty Towers and the complete failure there. She's come back again, but the idea that you're not allowed to have satire, that if anyone mentions anything to do, say, for example, with racism, that's got to be assumed to be racist rather than satirizing racism. It's now sedition satire in Hong Kong. A broadcaster we see last weekend cuts short a political satire show's 31 years. Agence France Press is reporting that. Cartoonists and journalists say self-censorship has already begun, blunting critical voices as fears crescendo over China's plan to impose sweeping anti-subversion laws in the restless city. For a man whose career has revolved around making people laugh, Nung Chi Sum had little to smile about last Friday. Huddled around the TV in a darkened studio, the comedian and a handful of colleagues watched the final episode of their satirical news show, Headliner, go live. The programme came to a close after a rebuke from regulators over a recent episode lampooning the police that prompted public broadcaster to end its 31-year run. What they're doing is just sending the police up, Martin, and that's it. That's now sedition in Hong Kong.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is an ongoing struggle between, the geopolitical needs of the government in Beijing and, the aspirations of people in Hong Kong. Incidentally, this week, Trump said if you burn an American flag, you can be sent to prison for 10 years. Not much satire there, eh?
Well, that sounds very un-American. Trump in many ways is very un-American. Anyway, look, let's have a listen now to Catherine Austin Fitz. Here she has some things to say about what she is thinking, that there are actually some links to 5G, but not between the virus and 5G, but not in the same way. She's basically saying, well, 5G is bad for your health, but also, obviously, the coronavirus is too. Don't get the two confused, but they're both separate. Anyway, let's have a listen to Catherine Austin Fitz now.
Now, I want to talk about the second wave. So the second wave is supposedly going to come in September. But here's what's going to happen in September. Because if you go back, and in fact, I think he lives in North Carolina. There's a one of the best authors who's written about the history of vaccinations is Forrest Moretti. And he has a series of books, and he does a masterful job of explaining the game of what I just did a review for a book called Virus Mania. But let's say, Greg, that you spray pesticides on the farms for agricultural, you know, and it makes everybody sick. If you admit that, then of course you have big liability. The insurance companies lose a lot of money. No good. So instead, you blame a virus, and then you invent a vaccination for the virus, and you give everybody the vaccination. And instead of losing money on the liability, you make money, and you attribute the, you know, you stop using the pesticide, and you attribute everybody getting well to the vaccination, which isn't true. They stop getting sick because you stop using the pesticide. Okay, so it's an old game, and it's designed to manage your liabilities. Now, why are they saying there's going to be a second wave? Do you know what's going to happen in September, October? They're going to finish getting all the Starlight or Starlink satellites up, and they're going to start turning 5G on, and they're turning it on all over the country. And that's going to, if you look at the history of radically increasing EMF radiation, sort of messing with human electromagnetic fields, that's going to make a lot of people sick, just like the vaccinations or the injections. I won't call them vaccinations because they're not medicine. The injections are going to make people sick, and the 5G is going to make people sick. And they need a cover story because they need for their plans of rolling out digital currencies and rolling out lots of robotics, they need 5G. 5G was invented by the Israelis for crowd control. It's a crowd control technology. It's not really a telecommunications technology. But if you look at all their plans, whether it's driverless cars or digital credit systems to replace the dollar, they need massive bandwidth. And of course, they know it's going to make a lot of people sick. So it wouldn't surprise me if the second wave is the cover story for all the extraordinary damage that's going to be done to our health by the injections. And if you look at the numbers, it's clear that the people who had this year's flu shot were much more likely to get COVID-19 and to suffer from it or die from it.
So that's Catherine Austin Fitz there, echoing what we were saying that Dolores Cahill from Ireland was saying, which is that the flu vaccine can actually quite enormously increase your vulnerability to COVID-19. Well, it's not the sort of thing that's very intuitive. You wouldn't think it had very much to do with it. It should surely protect you. But what this US Army study has shown is most clearly that it can make you far more vulnerable to COVID-19 after you've had a flu vaccine. And you won't hear that and see that on the TV and the mainstream media because it's really not part of the right story. But anyway, Martin, what she's saying there is really to do with a second wave possibly being caused by other things. Anyway, look, rather than just comment on that, let's go to another couple. We've got a couple of clips from Catherine Austin Fitz, and be nice to get your comments once we've heard them all. Here she is talking about the Bill Gates business model, which I found quite interesting, in that he kind of puts himself forward and Microsoft as this amazing company that just did really well. Well, actually, she paints a very different picture here.
We've literally created a database I call Creepy Technology, and there's what we know they can do now and where I think they're going. So I'm very clear that where I think they're going is trying to do a Microsoft Office system in your body. So Bill Gates's business model was he throws a Microsoft operating system in your computer. It has a back door. His business model is giving people access to all your data and your privacy, and you inundate the world with viruses so you can regularly update that.
Right. Yes.
And if you look at many of the things that have gone on to compromise the financial system and financial fraud, they couldn't have gone on with all those backdoors. Now, Microsoft was far from the only one. So I see Bill Gates and Microsoft as being a proprietary. Now, do you know what I mean when I say proprietary?
No, okay. What specifically?
Proprietary. In Washington, a proprietary was a business that looked like a private business but was totally beholden to the intelligence agencies. And so, you know, you would sit down and have a meeting with the CEO, would make a deal. You thought everything was fine, and then suddenly the deal would get unraveled. And it wasn't his board. It was, you know, Langley. In other words, his entire financial model depended on government contracts, government subsidy, government this, government that. And literally the intelligence agencies, they thought they owned and governed the company. So you get these weird situations where you have a board of directors that think they run the company, investors who think they run the company, intelligence agencies who think they run the company, and then a CEO who's just navigating between them. And it gets very bizarre because companies behave in what you and I would think of as highly non-economic ways. But that's because their business model is not the model in the annual report. Their business model is, you know, providing a backdoor to America for the NSA and the CIA.
Catherine Austin Fitz again there, Martin. I think fascinating analysis, really, saying that, well, several things, really, but one of the most fascinating is that there's at least four different strands of people who think they run Microsoft. Actually, none of them really do, or maybe one does, or maybe another one does. The investors in it, the chief executive and the executive board, then you'd have the board of directors, and then also the intelligence services, all grappling for control of a big company like Microsoft.
Well, I think the whole setup was set up by the military in the first place. The internet is basically their creature. And, of course, the intelligence services always saw it as a means of spying on the population. And Bill Gates, of course, was basically given the job of pretending to be the guy in charge of it for them.
Yeah, so IBM had been developing a lot of this technology and the NSA. And they didn't really want it to be rolled out as their, you know, a government thing or an IBM thing. So Bill Gates got the job of saying, well, you know, you're going to be the operating system man. Microsoft is going to be your baby and you're going to front it. But it is. It's, I mean, surely this is just really a front for the intelligence services, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, the US economy is supposedly a free market economy. But in practice, most of the leading sectors are military industrial complex, which is basically government money. Now, of course, we mentioned Kinetic earlier. I mean, that's what's happened in this country. But we used to have a government-owned weapons industry. They've still got a government-owned weapons industry in Russia. But, of course, what we've got here is private industry making profits out of what are essentially government.
I mean, isn't it natural, though, that everybody is going to be what we might call rent-seeking? They'll see areas where they can make a lot of money without really having to do much. Especially when they see government programs, they'll say, well, it would be nice to turn that into a little private company. That'll be a nest egg for me and my kids forevermore.
Well, that's right. And, the way the capitalism actually functions compared to the very, you know, the fairy stories about what goes on, you know, these guys invent stuff in their garages and suddenly they become super wealthy and we're all supposed to look up to them for being so super intelligent and to be able to do all of this. It's just basically a fairy story. The government, particularly in the US, is the dominant force in the economy, although the pretense is otherwise.
And what about this back door? Because they're saying, what they're saying there is that it basically allows the government, and I would imagine their favoured corporations, to do data mining throughout the whole of the Microsoft system, because they've provided these little back doors. The idea is that Microsoft get this contract so long as they don't mention the access that the intelligence services have to all of your personal data that's on your computer or anywhere near it.
Well, it's a symbiotic relationship, isn't it? Bill Gates gets to make loads of money and the intelligence services get to spy on everybody. What's not to like?
Well, that's certainly the way it certainly does seem. Alternatives? Well, there are alternatives. There is Linux, you know.
Well, that's right. I mean, you'll find, is it Red Hat they use in China? And the intelligence services in West Germany won't use Microsoft because it's just compromised.
Well, they know, but the question is, do we? Anyway, that's Catherine Austin Fitz. I mean, she does a very good job, I think, on and well worth tracking down some of her work at Solari. I think it's .com. I'm not sure. But anyway, I'll put a link up to her on our show page. Next down the list to look at is Mike Sparks. And I contacted Mike. He lives down in Alabama, and he's a former military officer in the U.S. Army. And I asked him because he's a bit of a historian. He likes his Confederate history and his Union history. He's very good on the American Civil War. So I thought I'd ask him, who is this guy Albert Pike, whose statue was torn down last weekend in Washington, D.C., although we didn't get very much coverage of it. It turns out that Albert Pike is actually quite an important, powerful character in U.S. history, mainly because he was Grand Master of the Scottish Rite of Freemasons in the U.S. at the time. So that means, well, he may have been a captain originally and then he became a general in the Confederate Army, but actually within the Masonic system, he was the boss, you know, so he was really in charge of, say, you know, the political masters who were supposedly directing the Confederate War. So I asked Mike Sparks all about Albert Pike. Who is this guy that his statue was pulled down?
He was a captain early in the Mexican War, but he became a general, you know, once the big shindig began between North and South here in the United States. He obviously had military expertise to lead bigger groups of men than just a company. And he was a cavalryman, you know, riding and fighting from horses. As a big man, he was like 6 feet tall and 300 pounds. I'd feel sorry for the horse. He was a lawyer, right? So he had a legal mind, a very intelligent legal mind, and he helped the Indians, believe it or not, in their cases against the U.S. government. So he had a streak of anti-authoritarianism running throughout. Even when he was in the army, he was in constant trouble with his superiors, and when he went into private law practice, he was taking on the Indians, you know, cases against the U.S. government, you know, obviously grabbing land continually. So he has some kind of social justice in him. You know, he's not somebody, you know, I'm going to lose sleep over because the statue got pulled down and defaced because he's considered to be an evil man because he was a, you know, a Mason doing all that dirty trick secret society stuff. But, you know, you want to say some good things when he did good things. You know, representing the Indians was a unselfish good thing that he did. He just, unfortunately, after that, went into serious religious thought to further his Masonic secret society, which, you know, is diametrically opposed to good by its very nature. Use the example, if you had a house, I had a house, and three other people had a house, and we all decided we're going to get together, and we're going to pay off your loan, you know, your mortgage this year, and the next year you're going to pay off my mortgage, and then Jill's, and Jim's, and in 5 years everybody's mortgage is paid off, and they own their home, guess what? That's not allowed, because you're pretending to be a bank. That's what secret societies do. They work behind the scenes to use these networking efficiencies. They're allowed to do it. Of course, you and I are not allowed to do it. I sent you a memo of the FBI showing that they had a guy in the American Legion fronting for them on the grand jury of Jim Garrison, you know, DA of New Orleans, prosecution of Clay Shaw. Yeah. He reassured the FBI, don't worry, I'm the foreman of the grand jury. I'm going to make sure only American Legion people are appointed to the grand jury, and we're going to make sure that Garrison's investigation goes nowhere. We're not going to badmouth the FBI. See what I mean? The FBI is totally permeated by the Masons and a lot of law enforcement. So, if the black hedonists had done their homework and protesting correctly, they would be protesting the right things about law enforcement, which is just too much Masonic control and influence of law enforcement. But instead, they just do the skin color thing.
So that's Mike Sparks. Martin, what he's saying there effectively is that this Freemasonic thing is permeating in the US, permeating the justice system. He's given an example there as he's saying that the district attorney is trying to prosecute Clay Shaw, Jim Garrison from New Orleans, after the Kennedy assassination. Actually, it turned out that the jury had been fixed. And I mean, this isn't necessarily a Masonic thing, but it's through the Legion, the American Legion, which is often associated with Freemasons. So it does make you wonder, doesn't it, just to what extent these secret societies, how powerful they are, particularly when someone like Albert Pike, you know, he's obviously quite a powerful figure. Many people didn't even know he was a senior Freemason.
Well, obviously, there's two different eras. I mean, Pike was around in the 19th century. JFK was assassinated in the 1960s. But the power of secret societies is clear. I mean, that's how elites operate. You know, we can probably make a list of them. The people who listen to this show will be very well aware of things like Skull and Bones, Bilderberg Group, Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, and there's probably all sorts of groups out there which we don't even know about, which are basically networking criminal elites to do their criminal thing.
It's well worth looking at this letter. And, you know, this letter of Albert Pike, I mean, if you look at it, you can see, actually, it may well not be true. It may be he didn't write this. It may be the whole thing has been fabricated. I mean, the fact that it mentions the Nazis, I mean, you'd have to be quite an amazing, like, Nostradamus character in order to get that into his letter. But Mazzini was a revolutionary leader in the mid-1800s. And he was over in Italy, really uniting Italy in a similar way that actually happened in America during the Civil War, with Pike being one of the senior people on the Confederate side and the military angle. And so the First World War, they said, must be brought about in order to permit the Illuminati to overthrow the power of the Tsars of Russia. Now, I mean, all these things in this letter, I won't go into it in that much detail. I put a link up on our show page. All these things actually did happen. The point being, though, that if you wanted to discredit a particular theory about Pike or about what was happening in world events, it would be quite simple. And I think this happened with the Protocols of Zion. What you do is you fabricate a document which actually does tell you what's going on, but you include in it several complete nonsenses and forgeries, so that if anybody picks it up and says, oh, this is true, then it's easy to discredit them. What do you think of that possible theory about the protocols and this letter of Albert Pike to Mazzini?
Well, the first point I'd make is people can predict the future, not by having any psychic powers or by pulling strings in secret societies. It's because the general thrust of what's going to happen is quite clear. I mean, I think we can confidently predict, as we're talking here now, that there will be some kind of World War III. We're already in it. And you don't really need any psychic powers to see it. It's in your face. It's been going on for ages. And I think the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was written originally by the Okhrana, which is the Russian secret service, as a means of whipping up anti-Jewish sentiment, which they then manipulated to keep the masses in Russia in subservience. And, you know, I don't really believe, I'm afraid, Tony, that the secret societies control events. They exist and they try to control
events. Don't put words in my mouth. I don't think they control events either. I think they have a great deal of influence over people, in particularly in senior positions. But, you know, actually controlling the world is surely a rather more like herding cats, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, anybody knows that. Mike Tyson said, "Everybody's got a plan until you get smashed in the mouth."
Yes. You know, and the Third World War. Anyway, you just talked about the Third World War. I think it's very well worth looking at this letter and the understanding that the letter itself may be a forgery, but what it's saying may well be true. So he's saying there that the Third World War must be fomented by taking advantage of the differences caused by the agents of the Illuminati between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. Well, this is what we're seeing. And in fact, he's there saying that the political Zionists, he's really talking there about the Zionist lobby in Israel and the Christian Zionists and the Zionist lobby abroad outside Israel. They're the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. Well, they're really talking about people like Nasrallah and the Iranians, surely.
Well, I find this rather bemusing, because nobody ever used the term Zionist before it was coined by Theodor Herzl in the 1890s. And by that stage, I think Pike was dead. So he certainly couldn't have called anything Zionist, because they didn't exist in that era.
Well, possibly. I think it may have gone earlier than that. But anyway, But the whole point here really is that, I mean, this letter may even have been written, you know, say in the early 1900s, or, you know, say 1905 or something. The idea really being to try and discredit the plan by issuing a document which is correct and it shows the plan, but it's a forgery. So this is what I'm saying, I suppose, comparing it to the Protocols of Zion. But anyway, let's have a listen now to what Mike Sparks has to say about the Pike letter. See if he agrees with you or not.
But I don't think that the letter's legit. It was originally a 19th century hoax by a guy named Tackville. And then in 1958, a guy named Carr embellished it with words that couldn't possibly have been known in the 1870s, like Nazism and fascism is in the letter that's, you know, being spread around. But you don't need that letter from Albert Pike to know that the Illuminati have been instigating wars. With the turn of the century industrial age, the Rothschilds acquired billions of dollars of money from the production of widgets that we didn't have before. Before, wealth was generated generally by agrarian farming. But mass production of widgets has put billions of dollars in power into the hands of the Illuminati.
Martin, what he's saying there is really that there's an enormous amount of money been made by the banksters. He mentions the Rothschilds there particularly, due to industrialization, and that this has really put a tremendous amount more power in their hands than it ever had before.
Well, who can deny that the financial power in the world is overweening and dominant? It's been going on for a long time, and it's coming to its apotheosis pretty soon, quite possibly. The banking system is going to collapse for good.
And it won't be just collapsing, will it? Because there's the Great Reset. Prince Charles is talking about this. The Bank for International Settlements is talking about it. Everyone's saying that we're going to have this reset. So they're obviously prepared something to take over from it all. Catherine Austin Fitz, in another interview I was listening to this week from her, says that it's going to be basically a kind of digital credit system whereby you don't actually have anything of value. The banking system just keeps a record of how much money you've got, and you can spend it or not spend it, depending on whether you have it. And she points out the problem with that is that you can have your wealth just turned on and off at the flick of a switch.
Well, that may be so, particularly in the more technologically advanced parts of the planet, but I don't see that happening very much in rural India, for example. Modi tried to get rid of cash because he was being put under pressure by USAID. Absolutely bonkers. I mean, a country like India, where most people, the large proportion of the population, haven't got any bank accounts. They really do need cash. And I can't see how they're going to get that round that.
OK, well, let's listen now to Mike Sparks on COVID-19, see what he's got to say about that.
The general question about the virus would be, do you think the Illuminati instigated it or not?
Do you think it's man-made or not?
Answer to that one, I think, is yes. Nation states have weapons labs, and they do biological warfare research. It's just a matter of time before they're going to want to use that research in an actual operation. You know, it's like if you've got a rubber ducky and you never take a bath, one of these days you're going to say, I need to take a bath and play with my rubber ducky. So you've got this thing wagging the tail of the dog. So if it was a Chinese weapon lab, an American weapon lab, one of them is guilty, or both, because, you know, the virus is new.
Martin, he's pretty convinced that it's man-made.
I tend to that view myself, but I don't think there's, you can be certain about these things, and you've got to keep an open mind. But it, what makes me, I think, is incredibly suspicious was the fact that they had pig flu in China, then bird flu, then this. And we know that the US has biological warfare capability at Fort Detrick. And incidentally, the DARPA, which is the it's mind-boggling to think, but DARPA, which is the weapons, you know, military part of the Pentagon, had investments in the Wuhan laboratory experimenting with bat coronaviruses. And, of course, they were also experimenting with bat coronaviruses from China inside the US. Now, the collapse of the financial services sector in September was followed by a warning to the Israeli Defense Forces by the Defense Intelligence Agency in the US about a pandemic coming from China in November, as we know from ABC News and from the Times of Israel, who obviously spoke to the IDF. Now, all of these circumstantial evidences suggest that this is a biological warfare attack, A, to try and mess up the Chinese before they really overtake the US, because that's where that's going. Don't forget there's an ongoing trade war going on, and trade wars are wars, you know. People die in them when the sanctions are placed on them, and so on. It makes it very, very difficult for people to function. And they're quite happy to have it blow back over the US for two reasons. They've got an excuse to bail the banks out. They've been bailed out even more humongously than they were in 2008, and hardly a whisper has been said about it, which in normal circumstances there would have been a hurricane of criticism. And, of course, the deep state in the US doesn't like Trump much anyway, so he certainly won't have been involved in it. So they've left him hanging in the wind. Because, you know, they've got these, you know, the deep state is now preparing probably for a Biden presidency, which will involve a confrontation with China and Russia. There's nobody you can vote for in the US who's not going to be pushing for war. It's bonkers.
Okay, so censorship. I mean, just to say that when we were recording Mike Sparks there, he's chatting away to us happily. As soon as we just about to get start to record, suddenly communication is completely dead, and we've had this before several times with particularly people who are connected to transhumanism and ex-military people in the US. It's almost as if it's very difficult to prove, but it did seem as if we were being cut off in the middle of the interview, so I had to do that not such good quality one on the phone, literally, afterwards. So there's that censorship. There's also, Martin, the censorship of that story you just said, and when we put that program up on YouTube just pulled it down straight away. I think this is the one about the warning that the Israelis gave.
To the Israelis by the Defense Intelligence Agency.
This is the Defense Intelligence Agency warning the Israelis about a pandemic last November. And that is, I mean, not been reported hardly at all, has it?
No, and it's of great importance. The implication has to be that they knew it was going to happen before it happened, which implies that they may have some agency in creating it. And it's been reported in the Times of Israel. So if you're listening, Keir Starmer, that's not an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. It's in the Times of Israel, paper of record in Israel. The defense and IDF in Israel were warned by the DIA of a pandemic coming from China in November, before the Chinese knew about it. This all suggests that there is a war being planned, and probably the Israeli intelligence services are in on all of this. And is that an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory? I don't care what they say. We're talking about military intelligence analysis here, and you can be quite sure that the Russians, the Chinese and the Iranians will have their analysts looking at all of this and making their minds up about where they're going to strike back, if they have to strike back.
Talking of censorship and propaganda, Wikipedia has become a bulletin board for corporate and imperial interests under the watch of its Randian founder, Jimmy Wales, and the veteran US regime change operative who heads the Wikimedia Foundation Catherine Miller. And this is on the Grey Zone. So Ayn Rand, loving founder. So the guy, Jimmy Wales, who founded it, is a big fan of Ayn Rand. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, I mean, it's basically right-wing libertarian stuff, isn't it? You know, and of course, Wikipedia and Facebook and Twitter, they are part of psychological warfare operations by the US state. And, you know, they just are. I can't see how anybody can deny it.
Well, that's right. A lot of the editing that goes on there, as Craig Murray pointed out, is done by one single person. And it's basically, as soon as the truth starts to appear on a Wikipedia page, this person appears and starts editing it out again.
So I've forgotten what the name of the guy is, but he's working round the clock, basically all day, 24 hours a day, editing Wikipedia. And what he's doing, this whoever it is, this bot, is slagging off people critical of the establishment and building up people like Elliot Higgins and Bellingcat who are in bed with the establishment.
So now, I mean, I can remember this sort of thing, Martin,
from people's minds
way back in the noughties when we were doing the campaigning around the 7/7 London bombings and pointing out, for example, Benjamin Netanyahu's presence in London, the fact that he got a warning from his embassy even though it was a surprise attack, and the fact that there were individuals. I can remember being spoken to by the people running various events saying that there was a character, I think it was called Rachel North, and it wasn't her real name because North's was supposed to be North London, that was appearing at several websites at the same time editing things. So basically it's one account being used by lots of people in order to, and this may be what's going on at Wikipedia. So there's a lot of scope for abuse, isn't there, of social media by whoever, by private interests, anyone with money who can pay somebody, or possibly even using artificial intelligence to put up messages, to spoil conversations, to obliterate facts, that sort of thing.
Well, WikiLeaks, one of the most significant things that they exposed was all of these cyber tactics, which are used by intelligence services and people like GCHQ. So, you know, they're basically involved in all sorts of skullduggery online. And we've got Brigade 77, which has got 1,000 members, we understand, all of whom are officers. And they spend all day, every day, online making stuff up and dissing people and bending the narrative by which people understand the reality that they're in. And what's it Karl Rove said a long time ago, you know, the advisor to Bush, he said, you people are in the reality-based community, and we're an empire now, and we are going to make things happen, and you're just going to respond to them. We can create our own reality. And, of course, that is exactly what they've been pushing for. I think one of the former head of the CIA, I've forgotten who he was, said, we will know that we have succeeded when everything that Americans believe about what's going on in the world has been fed to them by us.
Well, they're getting quite close to that through things like Operation Mockingbird. Anyway, look, let's have a, before we go to hear Peter Manning talking about his father, Paul Manning, let's have just a last little look at some of the events around the pandemic. Göttingen in Germany, a whole massive housing block has been quarantined, and there's been running fights and battles with police there. This is a really not a very good way, it seems to me, Martin. I don't know what you think, but to quarantine people by basically putting fencing all around their housing estate and blocking a whole load of residents in there so they can't get out. I mean, we did have the experience, didn't we, with the cruise ships at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, where it turned out that the people who were on the cruise ships were more likely to catch COVID-19 and die because they were being kept on there and there was no facilities for them on the outside. It seems like the same sort of thing is going on right now in Germany.
Well, I was reading earlier about what's happening north of Naples, where Bulgarian guest workers have been sealed into their apartment block, the several hundred of them. They've been sealed in by the army because they've got 50 cases of COVID in there. But very reprehensibly, mobs of Italians are throwing stones at them and generally being hostile towards them. I mean, this as time goes on, tempers are fraying. Some countries have done reasonably well in controlling what's going on. Others have been absolutely hopeless, in which we can include our own. And the consequences of this are going to carry on spiralling out of control where they've lost control.
I mean,
control.
Yeah, but it surely, you know, just from a medical point of view, how can it possibly make sense when there is an area of concentration of coronavirus to just simply say, oh, well, we're going to give up on these people. Let's just let them all catch it and they're not going to be allowed out.
Well, what they did in China was they basically, when they found people had got coronavirus, they were taken away to secure medical facilities where they were isolated. And they managed to do quite a good job of doing that. And they've had, what is it, not quite 4,000 deaths in the whole of China. We've got 60,000 plus. I think we can see who's got it right and who's got it wrong, can't we?
Yeah, well, so why on earth? I mean, it always seems to be happening to these migrant workers and ethnic minority communities in Germany, particularly. And you're talking about that in Italy too. It seems to
it's the sort of thing that happened during the Black Death, isn't it? You know, one of the things that happened as the Black Death went across Europe is the people went out and massacred the Jews because they thought that they were responsible for it. That people aren't always rational, are they?
Well, the police surely have to be. They're not in a position where, you know, I just cannot get my head around why it could make any medical sense whatsoever. It seems to me to be much more like a sort of flexing the muscles of a police state than doing something which is medically sensitive.
What it's doing is saying, you lot stay over there and we don't care how many of you get it as long as you don't infect us. And this kind of thing is totally wrong.
But surely these racist type actions by the police are surely going to backfire.
Well, I mean, we are seeing the norms of civilized life being trashed on every front, aren't we? Look at, you know, the looting in the banking system, the provocations like the assassination of Soleimani, hatred and hostility to the other, whoever the other is. It's you know, it's not a pretty sight, is it?
And then we had a couple of nights ago in Brixton a street party broken up by the police. The same last night in Notting Hill and between Mitcham and Streatham in London, another street party broken up by the police. And yet when it comes to certain events, such as protests by Black Lives Matter, the police don't seem to mind if people aren't social distancing. They're not breaking those up. And the same goes with the Liverpool Football Club, where they had a big celebration yesterday after winning some game. So what we're seeing is it almost seems as if the police, if it's a small enough gathering, the police will weigh in and break it up. And actually, you know, I mean, there's the basic point, Martin, is if the police do weigh in a situation like that, it's likely to make things worse.
Well, that's presumably what the operational policing decisions are based on. That some certain circumstances, if you're going to charge in there and so what happened in Bristol the other week, the police could have defended the statue with baton charges and so on, but that would have been a poor decision. And I understand that what's happened is they've now identified various people who they think were involved, and they'll pass that to the Crown Prosecution Service and they can have a look at it. But what's beginning to happen, and I can sense it around Bristol where I live in Easton and so on, is that people are just getting fed up with being locked down, and the government seems to have said that it's all over, and it's very hard to get back to the basic simple messages which we were working with originally. Now nobody really knows what the rules are. And when people don't know what the rules are, then they just do their own thing, don't they? And of course, once you've lost control of it like that, you've lost control of it. And
yeah, the figures are certainly not going through the roof, are they, of the virus? So maybe it is the right time to do this.
We're basically at the same position we were just before the lockdown. We've got back to that level. But the danger is, of course, that if everybody goes back to doing what they did before, we're just going to go shooting back up again. And, of course, there'll have to be then a second lockdown in the economy.
Well, what they're doing, I think you're exaggerating this. What they're doing is they're opening things up bit by bit, aren't they?
Well, they're saying that's what they want to do, but there's no rationality in it. They're opening certain things and not other things. They're making it up as they go along. They want the economy to work. But, you know, in New Zealand, they can open up the whole economy. They can do it because they crushed the virus. We haven't got anywhere near that.
Okay, so, well, let's have a look at Well, listen anyway to Paul Manning now talking about, again, my favourite topic is Martin Bormann. There are a couple of interviews here with him from the 1990s on the Dave Emery show on Spitfire List. The first one of the two sounds as if he might have had a drink or two, but this is much more coherent here. This is an incredible story, really, of a book written by his father, who was one of the top CBS journalists in the Second World War, reporting on Germany and the war in Europe. For American listeners, they would have known him, heard his voice on the radio, many of them. And he was a really superb journalist. And his son, Peter Manning, is the person who's being interviewed here by Dave Emery from Spitfire List. And it's also his brother. It was worth reminding everybody about the horrific bloody situation with his brother, where his brother Jerry was shot dead in cold blood in New York a little while after the book was published, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And I think that's probably the best recommendation you can almost ever have for reading a book. It's a fascinating book about economic history of the Third Reich and their economic warfare tactics, which were then taken up. And much of what's going on in the world today could well be because of the investments made with all this Nazi money from after the Second World War. Also, the publisher, Lyle Stewart, in 1981 of the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, had both of his legs broken. And we'll be hearing maybe a bit about that, but mainly to do with who Paul Manning was and the world in which he was working. So let's have a listen to his son, Peter Manning, now speaking to Dave Emery.
At the time, the journalists were real journalists. They weren't celebrity announcers. And at the end of World War II, the news team got replaced by people who were simply announcers who would toe the corporate line. So the real journalists, with a few exceptions, were just left out.
And what your father came across in studying the Nazi flight capital was the fact, incredible to the uninitiated and disturbing to those who know, that the Third Reich did not disappear but went underground.
Yeah, I think he didn't realize how big the story was. He was just a journalist. He found a few things out at the end of the war. You know, what happened to Martin Bormann was one of the stories he was chasing down. And he thought some Nazis got away and took money with them, ran off to South America, and he chased down this story. Then he came back to the U.S., had a career, and he stumbled back into the story in the 1960s. I know he was 100% of his time was put into this in the late 60s and going into the early 70s. This was sort of a six-day-a-week project. He went to Europe a few times. What he wanted to do is actually interview Martin Bormann. So he was in contact with the Martin Bormann people in Europe and down in South America. And actually in 1972 or 73, I'm not sure when, there was a very elaborate plan that three photographers from CBS would go down to South America with my father, and he would interview Martin Bormann live, and it would be the anchor up in New York would be Walter Cronkite. That plan fell through, and the reason given is that the younger people in the Bormann organization did not want to rock the boat or make themselves known, whereas the older members wanted to proudly tell their history of how they helped an emerging new West Germany and how they also helped to fight communism.
That great, albeit unpalatable truth to many, which is that the Reich did survive and went in an underground fashion.
Yeah, definitely. It was a worldwide organization, but it looked to be purely commercial. What you say about a Fourth Reich coming around, I've been thinking about this for years, and yeah, I agree. I think it's not just commercial, it's philosophical, and they do want to emerge sometime in the near future.
Just wanted to read into the record the remarkable correspondence that took place between your father and Heinrich Müller. Heinrich Müller, by the way, was the head of the Gestapo in World War II and then went underground with the Bormann organization and became its director of security. And it was an absolutely feared individual. Anybody who crossed the Bormann group, if Müller decided, they died. And that was simply the way it went. Reading now from your father's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. During years of research for this book, I have become aware of Heinrich Müller and his security force, which provides protection for the leadership in Latin America and wherever else they may travel to Europe and to the United States to check on investments and profits. Through intermediaries, I have attempted unceasingly to penetrate to the central core of the organization in South America, but have been denied access. At the last meeting that I know about, it was voted, quote, Herr Manning's writing would focus undue attention on our activities, and his request must once again be denied, unquote. The elderly leaders, including Reichsminister Bormann, who is now 80, wanted me on the scene to write of their side of the story, above all his story of one of the most amazing and successful financial and industrial cloaking actions in history, of which he is justifiably proud. I had sent word to Bormann that the true story, his first-hand account, should become a matter of historical record, and stated that I would be agreeable to writing it if I could tell his true story, warts and all. Back came the word, quote, You are a free-world journalist and can write as you think best. We, too, are interested only in truth, unquote. They agreed to my request to bring along a three-man camera crew from CBS News to film my conversations with Martin Bormann, and even approved my wish for at least a personal thumbprint of the former Reichsleiter and party minister, which would be positive proof of his identity. At the organization's request, I sent the background, names, photos, and credentials of this particular CBS cameramen, Lawrence Walter Pierce, Richard Henry Perez, and Odin Lester Kitzmiller, an award-winning camera crew which got the exclusive film coverage of the attempted assassination of Governor George Wallace when he was running for president. I'm sorry to say that the younger leaders, the ones in virtual command, voted no.
That's right. Since he got shot down after many attempts at trying to interview Bormann and get an interview, he decided to write a book and have it published in the West, in New York. And he got the book, he shopped it around, it got warmly accepted at the editorial level at Doubleday and Dutton. But once it got past the first editor, they come back a week or two later and say, now we can't do anything here. Well, he got a maverick publisher, Lyle Stewart, at the time to pick up the book, and it was published in a very conventional way, well edited and put out. So all this information came out during the early to mid-70s. He kept rewriting it, got it finally published around 1980-81, and got rave reviews all over the country, Atlantic City, Des Moines, Chicago. He was on a talk show, a live news talk show in Chicago, just rave reviews. However, there was absolute dead silence in the New York Times and the New York Book Review community. They would not review the book. They wouldn't mention it. They wouldn't pan it. They wouldn't say it was goofy. They just didn't mention it. So down in Washington also there was silence. There was no book reviews coming out of the town of Washington, D.C. And then also in Los Angeles, what with the movie making and the TV industry out there, there was a book review, but it really said a lot of bad things about the theory. If you read the book, my father uses a lot of facts and he builds a case and he states his theory.
Mm-hmm.
And you could believe it or not, but the facts are there. My father was blacklisted. They just wouldn't take him seriously.
Something that's interesting is the contrast between the apparent attitude of the Bormann group themselves. At least the old guard were interested in getting the story out. Reading from the introduction to your father's book, oddly, I encountered less resistance from Martin Bormann and his aging peers than I did from the cover-up groups in West Germany, Paris, London, Washington, and Wall Street. Bormann knows he is mortal, as are his cronies who have turned over the day-to-day direction of the Bormann organization to a younger leadership. The old guard want the story told, and the only point of friction is whether it should be before or after Fuhrer Bormann's demise. And he also writes earlier in the introduction, The closer I got to the truth, the more quiet attention I received from the forces surrounding and protecting Martin Bormann, and also from those who had a direct interest in halting my investigation. Over the period of years it took to research this book, I was the object of diligent observations by squads of Gestapo agents dispatched from South America by General Gestapo Mueller, who directs all security matters for Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, and his organization, the most remarkable business group anywhere in the secret world of today. Mueller's interest in me, an American journalist, confirmed the truth of my many interviews and my ongoing investigation. Bormann is alive, they don't want waves, so they have been willing to expend immense time and money in tracking me and my progress.
Yeah, well, he spent a lot of his time for many years, and it didn't pan out, didn't make a profit, didn't make any money, so the family didn't have too much money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also very emotionally draining because the people he had counted on to publicize this, he was treated like he was a lunatic. He had friends in the New York Times, old war correspondent buddies, who were very enthusiastic about the book when it was just about to be coming out and said, yeah, this is great, Paul. This is a big score for you. This is a coup. We definitely got to write something about this. But then they get back a week or so later and say, look, Paul, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I don't want to lose my pension.
Mm-hmm.
And these were, number one A writers for the New York Times, very respected, very well-known journalists. Also in the television world, he had friends who used to be correspondents who at first were going to help him and then just turned their back on him completely. He was kind of a simple guy. He's from the 20s and 30s. His generation were, things were black and white. He was a patriot. He was a journalist. But it was a very complicated world after TV came on the scene, and he just didn't get how complex the world was. He was just kept chasing this story, came out with his book. I don't know if it's still available, but he put about two decades of his life into it.
And came up with a very remarkable work. And if the truth about political reality is ever to be understood, people are going to have to come to terms with your father's remarkable book. Last week, Peter, you also mentioned the visible harassment that your father and your family received from the surveillance, from the surveillance, the agents of surveillance or the team.
Yeah, well, I was in high school at the time. Then in 1969, graduated, got into college down at NYU. So I was living at home again. But they'd always be telling stories about how someone would be following my mother, and these were not muggers or anything. These were just mysterious people who would be following and looking. Sometimes they'd a couple of guys once in New York City outside Saks Fifth Avenue kind of leaned up on her in a crowd and pulled the papers out of her hand and walked away. These are guys in gray business suits. Just weird things happening. The phone was bugged. He was being, watched by several people who wanted to know if he was onto something or who he was working for, if any, or if he was just a propagandist for some organization. But he was working absolutely alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
no one supported him. No one gave him any money to fund. It was totally his own doing.
You mentioned last week, too, that your brother Jerry's mysterious murder was believed by your father to have been in retribution for the book. Is that correct?
That's right.
And again, my condolences for his murder. No assailant ever found, nothing taken, just a...
No, never. It was just strange circumstances. Of course, New York City in 1993, that was their biggest year for homicides. It was over 1,000 homicides.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a dangerous city. I grew up there, lived there for many years. But it was middle of the afternoon on February on the top floor of a six-floor walk-up. He wasn't rich. He wasn't involved with bad guys or drugs or anything. He was just shot.
Nothing taken?
Nothing. Well, he didn't have anything. He was a painter, like Edward Hopper. There was no reason to mug him or steal from him.
And also, we should stress, there was no quarrel. He wasn't engaged in an argument.
No, it was just bang, 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 according to the neighbor. He went down to a store downstairs to get some stuff for an elderly resident of the floor,
mm-hmm,
who couldn't walk up and down six floors. So he ran up, as was his custom, to six floors, went into his apartment, came out to deliver the food to the elderly lady, and it was bang, 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 and that was it. I mean, it didn't appear to be any motive. Plus, he was a real kind guy. He wasn't involved with friction or fighting or anything. He was just a real sweet person.
Mm-hmm. And again, for those who might express skepticism that this would be connected with your father's work, I've seen things like that happen to people I know, including people who've had their children retaliated against for what they've done. That's not an uncommon scenario. And again, your father was of the conviction that this was in retaliation for the book.
Yeah, I mean, he went through World War II, and there was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of spy stories told. This was a reality. This is how things were done.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of friends who worked for the Secret Service in Britain and the spy operations during World War II who were American, because the journalists, it was all part of an effort, and it was typical for a journalist to be part of the military effort.
Mm-hmm.
There were censors then, but they all worked together. And he had a lot of friends from the war who eventually got into intelligence after World War II. He had a lot of sources.
Mm-hmm. Your father had received information or had done research indicating that the Borman Group had infiltrated the CIA, but the CIA did not know that.
Yeah, well, it's like it's a vaccine, but maybe it's tainted. We took German scientists into our space program. We needed them.
Right.
We utilized them. All of a sudden, after World War II, we're fighting the communists, so we need these talented Nazis to help us fight.
Mm-hmm.
So they came into our American intelligence community. They controlled it.
Right.
Even though most of the intelligence community were all patriots and hardworking and on the right track, there was a little inner circle that had their own different agenda. You take a look at American behavior in the world after World War II. It's coming out now that our intelligence community did a lot of really bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Coup d'etat against democratically elected communist leaders.
All kinds of people.
All over the place. Bringing guns into one area, taking drugs out, selling drugs here, taking the money to buy more guns to fund more wars.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of nasty things that ostensibly were done by the U.S., not in U.S. character.
Right.
We went to war in World War II to free the world and to oppress tyranny. And all of a sudden, after World War II, the U.S. character is doing all these really evil things. It doesn't add up. Maybe it was a Nazi influence that caused all this.
So that's Peter Manning there, the son of Paul Manning, the author of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Pretty articulate guy, I think you'd agree, Martin.
Yeah, and I've read the book, and it's well worth reading. And, I think what he said at the end there about the Nazis getting a big influence inside the U.S. intelligence community, that's certainly true. But I think, basically, the U.S. has always had a fairly reactionary attitude, but homegrown. You know, they were carrying out war crimes in the Philippines in the 1890s without any German help.
But, I mean, surely it was just sort of around the time before World War II in the 1930s, there was a real tussle for control of the country with the fascists, between the fascists represented by Bush's, Prescott Bush, people like this, trying to basically take over the country. And the idea that suddenly a load of Nazis are going to turn up in the intelligence service, the OSS, then the CIA. It's almost like a pact is done with the devil to clinch the deal.
Yeah, but I mean, don't forget they had links going with the Nazi Party going back before the war. Basically the West has got this fascist canker at the heart of it, and it's related. You know, all sorts of nasty stuff goes on, as people who listen to our show will realise.
I think one of the things that you said there, which entertains me, is the idea that the journalists have been removed and replaced by celebrity announcers.
Well, you know what's going on, Tony. I mean, the serious investigative journalism is not being carried out by the mainstream anymore. It's basically infotainment and psychological warfare. A lot of what media people consume is basically non. It doesn't tell you anything. It's just keeps your mind busy. You know, we were just mentioning earlier how Wikipedia works, and there's people working around the clock.
Okay, well let's sum up by talking about the whole Salisbury business, right? Because this is, I think, a good example of something that should be being talked about, but is just being talk rubbish. There is the alternative version of what we've been fed of these Russians coming over here on the Saker, which I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk last week. Basically, that Skripal was planning on doing a runner back to Russia with support of the FSB, spilling the beans on the faked up Trump Putin dossier. Yeah, so this is the Steele dossier, and we know that Steele was involved very closely with Skripal. So MI6 organised this whole so-called incident in order to, first of all, disappear Skripal and Julia, who were part of the escape plan, and B, inflict a monstrous slander on Russia and Putin. I think, you know, that version of events holds more water than the incredible official conspiracy theory.
Well, I tend to agree with you, obviously. But you'll be, as Craig Murray, the former ambassador, has pointed out, the average punter who doesn't pay too much attention, presumes they know what happened there, and it's evil Rasputin, the poisoner, because basically they're relying on people's memories of things like James Bond and all the rest of it, and that their actual understanding of what Russian politics is about, because it's quite complicated, Russian politics, not straightforward at all, that most people haven't got the wit or the inclination to look any deeper than the...
Okay, so what would have happened if Skripal had managed to go back to Russia to spill the beans on the faked-up Trump-Putin dossier?
Well, it could have led to the situation where Trump won the election anyway. But don't forget...
Well, Martin, what I'm trying to get at here is surely this would make Britain look really bad, wouldn't it?
Well, the MI6 are clearly aligned... The British establishment are clearly aligned with the war faction and the Democrat Party. They're not very happy with Trump. And that's what, you know, they're basically sticking their finger in. I mean, they're talking about the Russians fiddling US elections. It's the British and the Israelis who are fiddling US elections.
So do all these lies and propaganda in the long term, do they work?
Well, obviously they do. That's why they do it. I mean, it's all very well us talking to the choir here on our radio show and our well-informed audience, but for most people, they basically accept the rather stilted worldview that they're being fed. I mean, there's going to be a vote very shortly in Russia to change the constitution to allow Putin or anybody to have continuous, you know, they can be elected any number of times. And it looks as if they're going to get about 60% of the vote in favour of it. The Communist Party are opposed. They're the main opposition party in China, not in China, in Russia, but they haven't got enough support. But this is presented in, I was looking at The Guardian earlier, it's presented as Russia's fake vote. Well, what's fake about a vote where 60% of people
vote? Well, it's a fake vote because they don't like the outcome, and that seems to be happening
That just tells you everything you need to know, doesn't it, about what people's vision... Like
the Brexit referendum.
Well, I mean, it's the Brexit referendum has happened, but it was this is going to be much, you know, this is going to be much more emphatic than that rather close result.
It's actually what they're doing is quite interesting there, isn't it? It's basically a sort of mixture between a monarchy and a democracy. So someone can stay in power so long as they're regularly re-elected, they can carry on. I mean, that doesn't
That's the position in Britain. I mean, obviously, what you've got in the US is you can only have two terms as a president. And that's with the situation in Russia as well, as it is in France. But I think what Putin is doing, what he said is, look, I'm not necessarily going to carry on, but we've got to have a situation where we can carry on functioning. Because what will happen if we don't is round about now, I'm going to be running out of my presidential term and everybody's going to be rowing and arguing about who's going to replace me. Whereas if we do this, I mean, and don't forget, this was what Hugo Chavez did in Venezuela. You don't have, if people want to carry on voting for the same person, why not? There's no, what's the rule that says you've got to have somebody new and there's got to be two parties in power or whatever? It depends what people want, doesn't it? I mean, you know, the Mexican PRI, the Mexican Institutional Revolutionary Party, they're in power for decades. And the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan has been in power for decades. It's not entirely a democratic setup, but if that's what people want and that's what they've voted for, why should anybody else outside Russia decide?
So why is this a threat, and why do the Guardian not like it? So MI6 don't like it.
Well, I mean, it plays to the idea that Putin wants he basically just wants to hang on forever and keep power. I don't think he does want to hang on forever. I can imagine he probably wants to retire. But the problem is that the situation in Russia is so dire in terms of the conflicts with the West, the war in Syria and Ukraine, the potential collapse of the economy, sanctions. He just doesn't feel that anybody else would be able to manage and that's generally the view of the Russian population. They look at their leaders and think, well, actually, of all the people that might be running things, he's the one that's most likely to be able to manage to do it. And he's got a lot of support because he's been doing it for a long time. And he knows
he's far more popular than the leaders in the West.
Well, he is. And that's then presented in the West as this can't be right, because politicians in the West fight like cats in a sack, and one's in, one's out, you know, nobody gets to be in charge for very long. And in Russia, they've basically decided, don't forget, they went through a period of complete turmoil in the Yeltsin era, and people are rather grateful that they've now got a steady hand on the tiller of somebody who seems to know what they're doing.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guests. That is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You'll find this show's podcast story links, comment page, and contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend, Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. Well worth a listen. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m, but so far it hasn't been. The latest is this show might be back in November, but don't hold your breath, dear listeners. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.